Hello and welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course, on our podcast. I'm AD Packham and we are rocking around your Christmas tree in association with oldfootballshirts.com. Well, we left Selhurst Park on Monday scratching our heads about how we only came away with a point. Rarely have we been so dominant at the home of our greatest rivals, so it's frustrating not to have won. Today, we welcome Sheffield United to the Amex, who have surprised everyone this season and have not lost away from home from Bramall Lane this season. Can we blunt the blades? Joining me today is, of course, Alan Wares, and we welcome back a man who, like the Blades, is used to shouting, "Cut!" It's the film director of Kaiser, and now, stop the tour, Louis Miles. Hello,
you
good morning.
You wouldn't believe how much our eyebrows are doing a bungee jump at you enjoyed didn't you?
What time were you up in the morning?
Yeah.
Writing that one.
That was a long mental journey you went on there, wasn't it?
I did it ages ago, actually, but yeah.
Hello, Louis.
Welcome
back,
Louis.
How are you, mate?
I'm very well. Happy Christmas to everyone.
And to you too.
No, last time you were with us, you were telling us all about a Brazilian fella. You're not talking about that today?
No, we're going to be talking probably about the antithesis of a con man footballer who is addicted to women and the
illicit
underworld. we'll get onto it later.
It's a seedy story for all the wrong reasons.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a very serious story about the power of sport and the sporting movement in bringing down apartheid in South Africa.
An incredible story and a story brilliantly told. But like I say, we'll get onto that presently.
But first, you were there on Monday night, Louis. So, Palace, how was it?
It's been your first time you've been there for a while, isn't it?
Yeah, first time I went to a Brighton Palace game. I've been there obviously a few times with work when I used to work at BBC Sports, yeah. And used to occasionally pop to watch Wimbledon there when.
When they were rerouted
and all the rest of it. But it's been said in all media outlets, for 70 minutes we were absolutely dominant. But I don't think we created that many good chances.
No.
And I think that's probably the story of our season in a little way. Mm. But all the same, I mean, amazing for that 70 minutes to have that much domination. I haven't seen that for a long time.
You said you worked at BBC Sport. Give us a bit of background. What's your history here?
My break in television, I'd worked in radio for a long time, 5 Live and Radio 4, and then...
now you're slamming it down here.
Yeah. and then I got a job as an assistant producer at BBC Sport, and that means doing Match of the Day, cut the highlights. Wasn't much live football at the time. We had the championship matches, and then later on there was a lot more rugby, all the rest of it, Formula One. So I did all that, did the pieces, and then you move on to producing and all the rest of it. Lots of time spent in trucks, in car parks.
Actually, but just to let some daylight in upon magic a little bit there, you mentioned editing Match of the Day, which is a bugbear of most people, because it's pretty much can be an act of fiction. I mean, I often say I've been
to
watch...
Well, you can tell a new story, can't you?
Yeah, I watched two games today. I watched Brighton v Sheffield United, and then I watched Brighton v Sheffield United on the telly. It's just two completely different games, I have to say.
Yeah, of course. So, I mean, I think the thing is that when you're doing a match edit, the important thing is that you've got to show the chances and the major incidents of the games. And generally, especially on a Saturday, there are up to 8, sometimes 10 matches per 4 or 5 match days in the season, but you are limited to the amount of time that you are given by the programme editor, and generally it's between 5 and 7 minutes. Mm-hmm. You've got to have interviews in that package as well, and so I mean there would have been plenty of times, especially I would have thought under Graham Potter, I'd hold my hand up and watch too much Match of the Day this year, but we've had wonderful possession game, we've created a nearly chance, it's been okay, but actually visually on the television it doesn't come across very well. Mm-hmm. Say Palace, look at the Palace would be a good game. I think that would have been a very difficult game to edit, because in all reality I can think of the Aaron Moy shot. Mm-hmm. And the penalty claim for Montoya in the first half. Sure. I don't think there was any other real chances for us. Lots of good play.
Yeah.
Well, what do you put in?
You say that, but I mean, we'll come to the stats in a minute. But let's just start.
Getting back to Lewis' point very quickly. I think he raises a point there, and we'll talk about this in the rounds generally rather than the specifics in a minute. Is that yes? That we as non neutrals were loving the fact that. Yes, we got a lot of possession.
Yeah.
But from a television point of view, you just think, well, okay, well, there's a midfield battle here that Brighton are winning, but nothing else is happening.
Well, it's fantastic. You could have 2 minutes of possession and the ball could come across and it'll be a very weak shot to the keeper. Now, you'll be like, oh, that's brilliant, we're doing so well, that's got to be reflected. But in a limited time frame, you can't you can't put that into a match edit. So it really has to be quite crucial because, you know, if you think a goal in layman's terms... And BB Match of the Day is very good at this because they allow a chance to develop. So it's not like they're constrained by program rate. So they'll try and show the move before the chance happens. And realistically, it's roughly about 45 seconds for a goal because you've got to have the three replays afterwards, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it becomes very formulaic after a while once you've done enough of them.
Yeah.
But I can see why everyone's bone of most people's bone of contention probably will come to how they talk about afterwards these days as well, which is again limited for time. I mean, like, you've got a 5 minutes match edit, you've probably got a minute and a half to talk about it, so it'd be, you know, and by the time you're at the end
but
of the program it's like, right, major incident, who's doing well, who's doing not.
But do they talk about what they've seen on Match of the Day, or do they talk about the game as a whole?
I really enjoy doing analysis, and it's kind of one of those weird jobs that you get where you it's kind of like the entry level job in a way, because you're essentially just logging down the major chances and the time codes of where it goes in, and you sit with the pundits and you watch the games. And I started in the era of Alan Hansen and Loro, and I mean, I always remember Hansen just lying on the sofa half watching the golf, and you think he's not paying attention at all, and then at half time you've basically been writing loads of stuff, and then he would have highlighted a time code that he would just notice out of the corner of his eye, which you hadn't have noticed at all, and he said, that's going in the run. But there's obviously a lot of games going on, so I know they do this now because it was a big program debate just before the move to Salford of like how are we all working as a team. And actually, if you're producing a game to producing that match edit sometimes, and you know you're going to be down the running order, so back in the day it would have been like Wigan Blackburn or something like that, you would have you would then feed back to them and saying, right, if you haven't missed it then Leighton Baines down the left hand side has completely dominated the game, you need to like hear some examples. So you would feed back that way as well.
Sure.
Okay. I mean, it's absolutely fascinating.
It's fascinating. But it's kind of an insight as to as AD says, the game we think we see, or the game we see, and then making it televisionable. You know, like I say, we can have some brilliant possession, really nice move, nice bit of skill, nice bit of trickery. Yeah. You know, Gross's slow motion Cruyff turn. But if it actually is something that leads to nothing, or just sort of he then flops it and the chance goes into the back of Rose Ed, it's not for you guys.
I think a great example of that is the Bristol City playoff final game, which I remember being so anxious about being there.
And then
you go back and watch it, I was like, this is awful. Also, no chances happen in this
game. Absolutely. Well, Brighton Hereford, the most classic game, you watch it back, you know, you're terrified, your adrenaline's gone brown, and you watch the game back. I watched it back all 2 or 3 years ago. There is some YouTube clip with some Tony Millard and Jerry Ryan on there, and you're watching, you think, this is Preston Park football, this is terrible.
Yeah, well, you get so emotionally attached
absolutely
to it, as we did at Crystal Palace.
Absolutely. Which we're about to talk about now.
We did, and so Monday night up at the Palace, so there was some changes to the scene. Bissouma came in for the suspended Stevens, and Montoya came in for El Zati, who dropped to the bench. I was quite surprised to see Bissouma on there. I was
Who would you have gone for?
I thought El Zati was going to start because that is his position. So, as a central midfielder,
well, here's the Jerry Ryan, the Roman Vansalo. He seems to be a sort of a jack of all trades.
But I'd quite like to have seen him in his best position to see if it is his best position.
Yeah, but I would have thought maybe it's a bit of rotation because there's a lot of games coming up. But Bissouma, I thought, had a very good game.
He was superb. He worried me when he played against Liverpool. I thought he stank the place out, and this is in the face of Brighton doing quite well in the second half against Liverpool. I thought thought he was ring rusty, certainly then. He was doing things he shouldn't be doing. Hello, we're playing Liverpool. You're right, you might be able to get away with it against Palace. But actually, I think the first couple of things that happened, he grew in confidence and Palace backed away from him.
And then his best bit of the game was the creation of the goal. That switch pivot over to Trossard was a brilliant ball.
Absolutely.
Apart from it was proper. But yes, no, apart from it, that was fine.
It was Basuma.
We'll come to that in a minute.
Oh dear, now this could be slightly awkward. I mean, if you can't actually sort of work out which player it was.
It's Basuma. I've watched it back.
Yeah, poor Aid, he's now looking at his
nose.
With Al Zaati, I can see why he wouldn't have started. Like I said, I think he is more of a first choice player, and today, for instance, when we're playing Sheffield United, I suspect that Stevens will get his place back. You play your best 11, and Stevens is one of those, and Basuma, with all due respect to him, isn't yet. Never mind this sort of keep the shirt policy thing. But so what you've got is, I get the point about Al Zaati playing. I think Montoya also justified his place because he had been having a few wobbly games. So I could see why Al Zaati was dropped to the bench. I think what it was that the way that the game panned out kind of justified Potter's decisions.
It was Basuma. But we'll come to that. But I mean, it was. I mean,
hashtag awkward.
But with Basuma, he was very direct. He was driving at that Palace defence, and he
was trolling Zaha,
and he got a lot of shots away. In fact, in stats wise, we had in our Premier League history, it was the most shots we've ever had on goal in one game. It's 15 shots on goal, 10 on target.
How many of them were good though? That's the problem.
They were pot shots, weren't they? The
goalkeeper had to make a save out of all of
course.
Those,
yeah, so, yeah, of course, yeah, yeah.
But I mean, they were daisy cutters.
You say make a save. Just as in fell on it, they weren't. There was nothing that he had to go flying for. I don't recall like one he had to go flying for and hit around the post or anything like that.
But there was, Basuma did very, 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 very well.
The entire midfield did very well.
Yeah, I was going to say he linked very well with Proper and with Moy there. Now, I mean, obviously, Dale Stevens is available from suspension for today's game. Does he come straight back in, or did Biss do enough to keep his place?
You know, I could have sworn I just answered that 2 minutes ago.
I wasn't paying attention.
No, we're not.
Of course, Stevens comes back in. I think he's pivotal, quite literally, to how Potter plays or sets up his team. But Basuma's obviously done himself a lot of favours. And he reminded me of when he first started playing under Houghton, when he was bought on quite often than not to get the team up the pitch. And certainly played that role.
Well, rewind to the beginning of the season last season when we played Watford away. An absolute dirge of a performance. Not this season where we won 3-0 and we were just taking the mickey out of them. Last season we were absolutely terrible. And Basuma came on 65, 70 minutes, I think, for Gross, and did more in the first 10 seconds than Gross had done for the first 65 minutes. He really lifted the team, not to actually any greater heights, but you could see there was something. And I've got a feeling it was his debut, if I remember rightly. He really lifted the team to something. And under Houghton, we could see him as the next great thing. Now, the thing is, with Potter, everyone else has risen. In terms of moving the ball, playing it quicker, almost coming to a Basuma style, to the fact that I wouldn't say Basuma has actually been overtaken. His injuries haven't helped him, but he's not the standout player, not the exciting kind of box office needs to grab the game by the scruff of the neck player he was last season.
But it's interesting how you're
differing in styles.
It's interesting how your perception of a player changes over time, because last season was very excited to see him come on, whereas I mean, the reaction in the away end beforehand was like, oh no, Basuma's in the team, why is he doing that? And it's very quickly that's all changed just because he's not been part of this team so far this season.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, well, one player also stood out for us, and he's getting better and better with each game. Still hasn't quite got on the score sheet, but that's Aaron Moy. And as you mentioned earlier, that shot where he picked up the ball in halfway, drove at the Palace defence, and unleashes a venomous drive that goes agonisingly wide.
That was just one of the things he did. I mean, what it really doesn't sort of say, and we're back to the match of the day stuff, is, you know, the grind and the hard work and the graft. And the really good bits of skill that he had. You know, doing the little shoulder drop, the little half shimmy, and losing a Palace player and then linking up well with Montoya afterwards.
Well, I mean, I think I'm sure AD wants to get onto this about how we set up and our width, but I think he's crucial to Potter playing the style that he does, because he comes in, the ball goes to him, plays in between the lines, and he's very quick at creating space and moving the ball on. That's largely his game for Potter. And I mean, we first saw it in all its glory against Spurs, which was, I mean, it was very quick getting the ball from defence straight up to the two, to Maupé and Connolly. And he's been brilliant. I mean, he's an early contender for player of the season.
Even in a tight situation where the midfield is looking a little bit sort of packed, he'll have that thing of just that little hint of a shoulder drop, that little hint of a sort of I'm going this way and then goes that way. And within the first two or three paces, and I think this is Moyes' sort of his real magic, for want of a better term, is that within the first two or three paces, he's lost his man. Now, the man can get back, but he's then, the Moyes between the ball and the player, he's gone behind him. If the player wants to get the ball back, he's going to have to foul Moyes. And that two or three paces is absolutely crucial to, as Louis says, setting up the space. That's what it is. It's just bang, first two or three. I saw him do it time after time after time against Palace, and that's what created the space.
And what you mentioned the width there. I mean, it's something which with Potter, it's not something we see an awful lot of. And it generally, most of the stuff goes through the middle. But against Palace, we did actually have a little bit of width, and Montoya was given the freedom of Selhurst Park.
Well, very interesting the way we set up in that game. I did some, or have been filming with Leon Bailey, who's a Jamaican player at Leverkusen, and his breakthrough season at Leverkusen, where he won German Young Player of the Year, or for the Bundesliga, not German, obviously he's Jamaican, but Leverkusen for that first half of the season, he's so rapid, they played him at right back, and they shifted the midfield three and almost the forward three over to the left-hand side.
Well, by sort of 10, 15 yards.
Yeah, exactly. Thing, yeah. So basically, he was it left or right? I can't remember if he was left or right back. Anyway, he was right back or left back and the winger as well.
Way, yeah.
So he literally had the whole run, and that was his space. And that's what Montoya was on Monday, as far as I could see. I mean, there was rarely anyone with him. To pass to all the rest
but
of it.
But in both cases, I can't help feeling that Palace almost conceded the width to us, because on the other side he had Trossard. So there was times when, again, the whole point of moving the ball about is not to move your team about, it's to move the opposition, and you want to move the opposition over. And they were doing it with the other side on Trossard as well. And Dan Byrne was supporting him.
But, you'll rarely hear me say this publicly, but I think there's kudos to Palace to the way that they did defend so well.
Yeah.
I mean, there were so many players behind the ball. I mean, Zaha admitted as much afterwards, which is we didn't have the ball.
Yeah.
We had to stop Brighton playing, and they didn't really get moved too much.
Hodgson's got this way that he trains the defenders, where he actually ties them all together with the rope, and you could actually see that line moving
together.
It was quite impressive.
No, they're very, very, very well organised. And they have got some good players, and obviously we played a team that had a lot of players out, but you knew that they were going to go at some point.
Yes.
Okay. You knew it was going to change at some point.
Okay, well, let's just move it on anyway. So there was a beautiful ball from Davey Proper, and it put Montoya through on goal, and Rinderwald gets nowhere near the ball and impedes Montoya, and he somehow still managed to get shot away whilst unbalanced. Now
you've been ranting, and I've all week, so it's Louis' turn.
I was having a coffee. Look, I mean, in the ground, we all just, well, where I was, we thought, well, that's got to be a penalty. And then no one appealed to it. So we thought, well, obviously not.
Yeah.
But then you only have to take one look at the replay to realise that it's clearly a penalty. You should probably learn from Connolly against Everton. You've got to make it
a bit more dramatic.
And that Connolly incident, I mean, they're now saying that shouldn't have been given as a penalty, but as far as I can see, it's a clear penalty.
The yardstick is if it's a foul anywhere else on the pitch, it's a penalty.
Connolly against Everton would have got to the ball if he hadn't stood on his feet, even though it was unintentional. In this game, the Montoya got a shot away, and it was a good shot and a good save. So the referees, they probably thought, well, it hasn't impeded him doing it, etc., etc. He should have just gone down.
Well, the thing is, I mean, you want your players to be honest. But was he?
No, but it was
honest?
A foul. I mean, like, it was a foul.
It's not about Montoya's reaction. That's irrelevant. It's about whether the player has, as you said, impeded him.
Yeah.
Now, he slipped over as he's got his shot away, and I'm not 100% sure as to whether that was him being impeded. that made him sort of like lose his balance, or if he just had slightly overrun the ball anyway.
There was a clear point of contact.
Yes.
I mean, for me, I think that's. And I, well, look, I mean, Sky Sports were saying it as well.
So then, but the thing, as I understand it, and I could be wrong here, is that the reason that the VAR didn't give it was because he got his shot away, which for me is totally irrelevant.
Well, I'm assuming that's the reason why. Yeah.
In other words, it's a mini
play-on. And also, it wasn't, you know. It was a decent chance, you know. He got a decent connection on it. It was a good chance. It was a good save.
Have we had a Montoya goal yet?
Not yet. Okay. He's getting closer. Okay. As is Moy. What are the odds on those today? Have a look.
Don't.
Well, it worked for proper the other day. So well.
I should have listened to you.
And then he gave the goal away straight away. So let's not go too far on that one.
Okay. And then, the VAR disagreed with that as we just discussed. Got a corner though. Dunk should have scored from the corner with a free header, pretty much.
We should be doing it.
Astonishing how many
set pieces.
Oh. Yeah. Now, the only one that springs to mind that we've scored from, I could be wrong, is against Man U. Okay.
Mm. Well, I mean, we were talking throughout the game, Al, that I thought Trossard was okay. You completely disagreed and thought he was completely rubbish.
I thought actually, for the most part, the ball in from the width was actually very poor. And I'm saying both sides. As good a game as Montoya had, and keeping the wide players quiet on the relative terms. Now, the build-up with Moy and Montoya on one side and Burn and Trossard on the other side, we absolutely went through them like a dose of salts until we got to within 10 yards of the penalty area, and then we faffed and played about and mucked about, and the ball in for the most part, and we do have to make the exception for the goal, it was a good one, but for the most part the quality in was just abysmal.
I mean, I think that's the story of our season though.
Yes, it is,
and I think that's the
do you go along with that?
Oh, 100%. And I think compared to Houghton, I think this is probably the bit where we regressed a bit. Whereas, I mean, Murray joined us from Bournemouth because we got balls into the box quickly. Mm. We don't do that now. We don't play with wingers. And that's fine. I mean, this is just a style of play.
Sure.
But the cute little balls that we need to be playing are also not necessarily being played all the time. So we're in a transition season, I think.
Yeah.
So, you know, we'll see how it develops.
But the one time that Trossard did swap sides, we scored.
Yeah, I'm not sure if that was deliberate or accidental, because they immediately swapped straight back again. But
what a cross.
It was a perfect ball from Bissouma. Bissouma.
Yeah.
Bissouma.
Bissouma pings the ball out to Trossard, who puts it in first time to find Morpai, who finds the back of the net.
Touch
of gross.
Touch of gross.
Touch of gross.
I don't want to be sort of cynical here, but was that a sort of perfectly cushioned pass, or did he just sort of like, you know, put it back into the area and hoping that someone was there?
I think Trossard's a good enough player to see.
Okay,
that.
All right, I'll buy that. But yeah, Dan Burn's sort of elaborate step over and nicely finished. I mean, like Zaha's goal, which I'm sure we're going to sort of, you know, spend 3 seconds talking about. It's the fact is, it was still a crowded box, and he pinged it into the corner into a corner that, you know, was otherwise vacant. If he'd have tried to slot it anywhere else, it probably would have been defended well.
Now, Alan, you'd like to talk about Morpai's outhousery.
Outhousery, yes. We're not allowed to swear on the radio. we did actually sort of think, what words can we use apart from the real sort of online thing? So, yes, he did outhouse the players in the way that he did when he was playing for Brentford last season to the Leeds United fans.
Yeah, the family stand. Good work.
Yes. Scored a penalty and then sort of went completely and sort of. So, he did that to the Palace. Now, to be fair, Knockhart did that last year. He did it against Sheffield Wednesday last year. So, yeah. You want that kind of villain. You hate that person doing it against you, but you find it hilarious. You cannot actually get cross with a player doing it against your team when you've got someone who's doing it for your team.
Billy Sharp today, Al.
Is he?
Well, I hope he's not, no, but he is playing, I think.
He's ancient.
Yeah, I know. But, okay, well, we did create a few more chances. The keeper kept shots raining on the Palace goal, but nothing really...
They were long-range pot shots, though, for the most part.
But there was one...
I've got hiccups now. Have you got a stat for shots on target from inside the area?
No.
Apart from the goal. See, that's the thing is that, you know, it was great that we think, oh, someone please shoot. I mean, we've been screaming about it for ages. Someone take a shot. Take a shot. We do. Fine. It's on target. Fine. But, you know, we're back to Louis' point. You know, we created. You can't say that a pot shot is creating a chance.
It reminds me a little bit of Gus Poyet era.
Yeah. Yeah.
This sort of, you know, lots of chances, most of them not particularly good.
Yeah.
And okay.
Well, I just want to talk about Neil Maupai, though. I mean, obviously, it was a great finish for the goal, but is it a worry that it takes him about four or five chances to actually get put one away?
Not for me. I think if you said at the start of the season we paid X amount, whatever it was, we paid for him 20 million, and, you know, we were two games away from halfway and he's already got seven, I think you'd take that.
There was a clever corner routine which saw Gross play to proper on the apex of the box, and he chipped it to the back post, causing panic in the Palace box, and Maupai really should have finished.
I actually thought that
that happened very quickly.
Well, the thing is also it helped that the keeper had a dropsy there, but yeah, I actually thought it was going to be one of those that all right, it was proper, you say, that chipped it.
Yeah.
I thought that actually that's one of those where you should actually take a shot. But if it's slightly behind him, the best you can do, because if you take a touch, you're going to get closed down, is chip it. But when the chip came in, I'm thinking, oh, my God. But, like I say, it nearly created a chance on account of the fact that the keeper spilt it.
Mm. OK, well, 73 minutes into the game, Palace decided to turn up, and they made a change. They brought on Max Meyer, who completely changed their... Basically, they were getting overrun in midfield. They put another midfield on, but it took them that long to do it. And all of a sudden, they started to attack us. And
it didn't... It also helped the fact that our lot, I think, looked dead on their feet as well. I mean,
to be fair, Max Meyer is a fantastic player, and I think he was a bit of a bad boy in Germany,
right.
And so they picked him up for free. And I remember thinking that's a very, very good signing. And I said to the people around us that this will change the game, and obviously the usual people swearing at Palace and all the rest of it. But he did. He took control of that midfield and started playing the ball and finding the space. And they pushed forward as well. I mean, they had to come out.
And their number 11 did equalise. Should he still have been on the pitch?
Oh, crikey. I think that a lot of people actually at the game didn't see this necessarily. I mean, Basuma, after 4 or 5 minutes, Basuma, he did foul Zahar, just came into him from the back. It was a free kick, get up. But instead, Zahar lashed out with his feet. No worse, in fact, probably worse than Beckham. I know you shouldn't compare and contrast stuff 20 years previously, but he did lash out at him. The referee did see it because... And we have VAR. I'm amazed that actually... If that is kind of considered violent conduct, if he was on his feet and did exactly the same, he'd have been straight redded. I have no idea why he didn't get a straight red for that.
We couldn't work it out. And that was a talk.
Are you familiar with the incident that we're talking about, Louis?
No, AD did mention it during the week, and then I failed to look at it, and then figured obviously VAR looked at it.
Poor editing.
But it was violent conduct. It should have been a straight red. But in a nice act of symmetry. He scored a goal, as did Anthony Knockhart, who should have been sent off in
Palace last year.
So look, I mean, I think it was a very good goal. He's a fantastic football player. We can't, you know, despite the sometimes comedy anger against him. I mean, he's
a good
player. Also not going to be there for much longer. So
is he going?
I would have thought so. I mean,
supposed to be going in August, wasn't he?
Yeah, but I think, you know, to be fair to Zaha, he probably deserves to have a better platform than Crystal Palace to show.
Okay, well, go large on Palace.
Disappointed that we didn't react quick enough. I thought it took a long time to make a substitution.
Correct. Trossard looked dead on his feet, and
Okay, well, it ended up on as even. 2 points drop, though?
Yeah. Okay. Well, although they had the better chances.
Okay. You are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and, of course, on our podcast. I'm here with Lou Miles, Alan Wares, I'm AD Packham, and we are brought to you in association with the fabulous oldfootballshirts.com. And I'm just going to hand this thing over to Louis to have a look at and see if you can describe that one for me.
Well, that has got absolutely everything on it. It is a black and red Adidas shirt with... lots of sponsors, including something that says Nordic Moving on it. So I'm guessing it's a Norway-type shirt. Who it is, I don't know.
That's got everything. I mean, Lewis just shown it to me.
Yeah.
It does look more like a Formula One jacket. There are at least a dozen sponsors on there. Yes, apart from that, there is a kind of touch of Nordic about it. So with that, I'm going to say it's Italian.
I can only say Mulder because that's all I know.
Okay. It's not, and well, this is what Phil has to say about this one. He says, "Seeing it's Christmas, I thought I'd give you a shirt with lots of decorations." There's 15 sponsors' logos on the front of this one.
Is that allowed? It's not allowed in this country, is it?
No, not in this country. Yeah. But this is the 2005 to 2006 home shirt of Östersunds Football Club from the central region of Sweden. On the banks of the Storsjön,
which is the
fifth largest lake in Sweden, and of course it is indeed the first club that Graham Potter managed between 2011 and 2018. Home is the 9,165 capacity Jamkraft Arena, which was built in 2007, and the ground is officially shared with Östersunds DFF, who play in the Elitettan League, which is the second highest women's football league in Sweden. In 2007, Östersunds began a cooperation with Swansea City, an arrangement that saw loan players play in Sweden and ultimately lead to the recommendation and recruitment of Graham Potter. Once Graham got going, he achieved successive promotions and the side made it to the Allsvenskan, which is the top flight of Swedish football, in 2015. After the chairman Daniel Kindberg was arrested and charged with all sorts of financial irregularities in 2018, Graham Potter made excuses and left and took over as manager of Swansea. It's fair to say there are a few links to the UK. The current squad features 11 English players, and there's an ex-Palace trainee, someone who's once on the books of Leeds, and a bloke who spent his entire career as part of Chelsea's lone army. Notable players from the past include, well, actually, there aren't any.
No.
Happy Christmas, everyone, and I hope Santa brings you lots of lovely football shirts. Thanks, Phil.
Absolutely, thanks for that.
I was just speaking to their goalkeeper coach this morning.
Oh, show off, go on.
David Preece. He was very kind about Kaiser, and so we message each other every now and again. Mm. And they find out there's a court case that ends on Monday, which they find out whether they're going to get relegated or not. So I think he's on tenterhooks, and the whole team is on tenterhooks. But so,
okay, you just mentioned a film there, didn't you?
I did.
Tell us what you do for a living.
I make TV and films. So
what's the next big project coming out?
We've just wrapped, and it's coming out on BT Sports on the 27th and 28th of December, and then we'll be on one of the major broadcasters earlier in the next year. Mm. We're just having a little one, but it is called Stop the Tour, and it is about, it's a film about the sporting protests against South Africa, which were 50 years old. Mm-hmm. They started 50 years ago, led by Peter Hain, now Lord Hain, who was obviously a major part of Tony Blair's cabinet. Peter was a South African exile. His whole family had been kicked out of the country, as one of the very few white families that were anti-apartheid and protest, and they worked with Mandela a lot. And it became a worldwide movement, which stopped the South Africans from touring in rugby and cricket, had major, major impacts within South Africa and on the societies here in the UK and in Australia and New Zealand. It's a before I started doing it, I didn't know too much about it, and it's a very, very powerful story showing the power of sport. And how crucial it was in bringing down apartheid. Because without this,
absolutely,
it wouldn't have happened.
Why do you think this film hasn't been made before?
I think parts of it have. I think there was a documentary series about 10 years ago, which featured this and other bits. But I think it was just the right time to do it, I think.
Well, you said yourself it's timing with the 50th anniversary. Was it the rugby or the cricket tour in 1970?
So it was both. So they start. So basically, the whole thing came about. Peter moved over with his family. There was a thing called the Basil D'Oliveira affair, who was a very famous South African cricketer who ended up playing for England.
Because he was a non-white.
He dominated an Ashes series or an Ashes test against Australia. Scoring 158 and then bowling key wickets and getting them out. And the next tour was against Australia. He should have been a shoo-in, because it was a bit like KP's sort of you know, KP's sort of antics when he first started the England team, but he wasn't picked to go to South Africa because there was a subsequently shown as a deal done between the South Africans and the British, or the English, the ECB, not to take him. Then some got injured, and because of all the furore about it, they put him in, and then the South African president banned the England team for coming, mm-hmm. Which normally would be enough to stop relations. But then a couple of months later, the English invited the South Africans over for a 1970 tour. And then at that point, the movement really kicked off. And it was like the Brexit of the day. I mean, it was front page newspapers every single day. It was on bulletins all the time. It was the big talking point because for large amounts of UK society, you've got these sort of, you're in a time of mass protest anyway with mm-hmm. Vietnam and obviously Black rights in America.
Banned the bomb and everything. Yeah.
But this was stopping something that people really liked. You know, this is the first real form of direct non-violent action. So you'd had the Mexico Olympics where you had the Black Power salute, the Amanla salute. But actually here what was happening was people were stopping games. They were running on the pitch. And it was pretty violent in certain places, especially in Wales, very, very violent. So it was dominating the news for a good year. And then eventually brought around the stopping of the 1970 cricket tour, but only very close to it actually happening.
But the weird thing is as much as sort of like the vast majority of society now would be very much anti-apartheid, back in those days, society probably wasn't as fussed. I wouldn't say they were pro or anti. They probably just weren't as fussed.
I don't think people were aware.
And they weren't aware. I mean, even in the film, and I don't think this is a spoiler, you're talking to South African players in there who didn't, the society they've grown up in, and then they come over to England and see something completely different. I liken it to when, for instance, Motown stars came over to England, were called sir and were allowed in the same door as their white colleagues. There's kind of that sort of thing. And so, you know, the whole thing of, and we can move further on to gay rights and workers' rights and civil rights and what have you, where the people who are protesting are considered extremists, whereas now you're looking and think, well, hang on, why did they have to protest in the first place? So it's very much a sort of historical documentary, isn't it?
Well, yes, but also, I mean, it in a sense, when you pitch it, you can sound potentially quite a bit dull, it's a bit rights and the rest of it. Actually, it's a very, very, very powerful human story, or lots of human stories, because not only are you highlighting a very detailed forensic racist state in South Africa, and I remember Mandela coming out as a child, and I remember the 95 World Cup, and if you've got the whole Invictus moment and all the rest of it, but I don't think people of my generation really know too much about it. I'm not sure people prior to it would know that much about it, because everything was so controlled in South Africa. There was no television until 1975.
The South African rugby player that you talked to in the film, again, it's not a spoiler.
Tommy Bedford, yeah.
I mean, he was kind of just sort of blown away about sort of English society, which was completely at odds to what he grew up with.
Yeah, I mean, and look, it's, and it's, you know, a lot of people are caught up in this story. We've got four prime ministers in this film. And we could have done three, four parts on this, because there were so many different, you have the Commonwealth Games in 86, you kind of got, we don't even touch Thatcher's relationship with South Africa. It's a very, very detailed thing. But powerful as well. And it's about statecraft, it's about message, it's about control, and it's also about the power of sport, which is really, really, really sort of poignant to today. Now, the sport was PR to the South Africans.
Absolutely.
So the Springboks coming over, the cricket, they were the best in the world at the time. Yep. They're the best in the world in rugby now. So when they came over, it was a big thing to have it, and it was very much a soft PR thing. And to stop it was vitally, vitally important. And you think about what's happening now with various football clubs being owned by states and foreign actors and all the rest of it, and you start actually having to start examining what that means when you've got a club owned by an oligarch, when you've got a state owning a football club. What are they doing it for? And how does your perception, because they're now a good side, Does that change your perception of the state? Does that allow you to allow them to get away with something a bit they shouldn't do?
Now Louis, the film opens with South Africa winning the Rugby World Cup this year with the black captain, which was a very, very poignant thing, and obviously something which helps in the film.
Now, yeah, we had to rewrite the whole thing. Yes. So,
because I was going to say it was in pre-production, in production prior to that. So, I mean, how much does that actually help you?
Massively so, and I think it's made so Sir Trevor McDonald narrates the film.
Yeah, that's a major coup, isn't it?
Yeah, massive. And we were going to ask Chester Williams, and I just got his number. I was just about to dial it, and then I don't know why I'm laughing, but it got announced that he'd passed away. I was literally about to press go, and it came up as a breaking thing. It was very odd.
But you have that power.
Yeah. Don't come too near me.
Please
don't give me a number.
Don't come
But no. So Trevor was delighted to do it. He obviously knew Peter and covered it as a BBC journalist. But he was also the first person to interview Mandela. He was in Soweto. And he was at the Invictus moment as a pitchside reporter for ITV, so very, very closely related to the story, and he was amazing to work with. So I'd literally we'd sent off the rough cut to him on the Friday and the script and everything, said, oh look, this might change, but I think I was very confident of an England victory. And then obviously it did change, and then it was so poignant, I think it certainly helps the story because it gives it real context now. That moment would not have happened without this struggle.
Yeah.
That multiracial team would be an impossibility under apartheid. And be very clear, they were not nice, the apartheid government people. They would kill people. They brutalised people.
Prison people.
Yeah, I mean, Sia Khaleesi is from a township in Port Elizabeth. I mean, he was so eloquent. And I've met Khaleesi in South Africa. And I think this is a mark of the man. We went to go and interview him at Stormers. Everything was arranged, and then the Springboks pulled it last minute, and he made an effort to come over to us and then tried to plead with the Springboks, say, look, these guys are calm, we need to do it. And then we spent 20 minutes talking about football and this film and everything, what it means. And he was an absolutely delightful man and a very, very good example of how to act as a sportsman. Because I think those words that came out of his mouth... when he was with Brian Habana and saying that, look, when I was growing up, I didn't dream about being a Rugby World Cup captain. I dreamt about my next meal. And it wasn't done in a pleading way. It was just reality and what it meant. And you could see what it meant to the whole country. And South Africa is a broken country still. There is, just because apartheid doesn't exist anymore doesn't mean that there's not problems there. There's a lot of problems there.
Well, the historical thing is not going to necessarily just go away overnight, is it?
You can't scrub away apartheid. And look, I mean, we had a screening of this to press and the South African High Commission and Mandela's family, and this High Commissioner is Oliver Tambo's daughter. And I was so surprised afterwards when they came out and said, look, this isn't taught in South Africa. These apartheid years, and this story isn't taught.
Oh, really?
And they're going to be taught in schools.
So it's a good...
This is going to be shown in South Africa?
This is going to be in the South African curriculum. So every child in South Africa will be watching this film and realising what it does. Not because it's... And I think the way they've done it is because it's not in a preachy way. They said, Peter Hain's
telling his story, isn't he? The best he could do is he's done it from his perspective. He looks at it obviously from a certain, sort of white privileged perspective, but one which he despised and his family despised, and like you say, were kind of kicked out / encouraged to leave South Africa, lest something out. Because they had a phrase, was it became a non-person, wasn't it?
So his mother and father were banned as citizens, and which meant they couldn't even communicate with each other.
Yeah.
I was somewhere on Wednesday looking at another potential film, and I met two guys who had been Conservative mayors at various places and been part of the party, and they're a bit old, and they've got this incredible story, and we're hoping to do it. And they both said, look, we hated Peter Hain at the time, it was this left wing radical, but then when you look at this film you realise it's like, oh, there's nothing radical about him. You would do the same.
Well, that's what I mean about society shifting. What was then considered extremist is actually very much the centre ground now.
Absolutely,
in that sense.
Okay, so that's Stop the Tour. When's it on again?
So 27th is the non is the non post Watershed version, and then there's a slightly lighter one with less, you know,
less graphic.
Yeah, no swearing, but obviously some of it can be disturbing. I would.
Are you going to take this out into theatres?
No, I think a TV run would be good. We expect it to go out in Australia and New Zealand. It will be going out in South Africa, and then, as I said before, we're just talking to the terrestrial broadcasters here about getting ahead of the Six Nations.
Okay.
But BT, if you don't have BT, it'll be free on the website as well, so go and have a look.
Fantastic.
And it is well worth watching. Yeah. It's such an important story to be told.
Superb. So then, congratulations, mate.
Cracking soundtrack as well, if you like any non-commercial music.
Okay, let's move it on now. Okay, over the last few weeks, we've been looking at the Albion team of the decade. Now, so far, Al, in goal, we have
Matty Ryan.
At left back, we have
It was Wayne Bridge, wasn't it?
It was. Central defenders.
Now then, I think that we should have the right, because the number of people we've got coming on who are actually want to change their mind, and I'm minded to do so. It was originally Duffy and Dunk. The number of people have said I'd have Upson instead of Duffy. I think we can have a last minute substitution, so I think we're going to go for Dunk and Upson here. Agreed? It's not just you, Louis.
But don't get a chance to choose the midfielders or the defenders. I would have had Upson in over Duffy, just because he was a better player.
But you wanted to put Ryan Harley in the team earlier, so...
No, I didn't. I just said he was a nice guy.
Because he used to live with you.
He used to live with my parents, yeah. Ryan Harley... my parents run a bed and breakfast and have some studios, and when he came back on loan from wherever he went to...
Exeter?
Yeah. Was he back to Exeter? Yeah. Was it MK Dons? I can't remember. He's at MK Dons now, isn't he?
Anyway, he stayed
at the house for 3 months, and he was a nice man, which he is.
Absolutely.
You wanted more pace in the midfield, because as it stands at the moment, midfield was Vicente.
Hang on, we haven't got to the right back yet.
Oh, yeah, Bruno.
Slow down, Rode. I'm actually minded to put right, okay, because this is important, obviously, and it's so much riding on it. I think we're going to do this. We're going to have Upson instead of Duffy. Don't get me wrong, obviously, Dunk and Duffy are sort of like very synonymous as being this gestalt entity, but Matty Upson was better, wasn't he?
He did win Player of the Year, didn't he? I think.
Yes, he did.
So did Duffy, it's not taking it away from Duffy, I think.
So did Bridge.
Has been excellent. No, I don't think Bruno did, and he absolutely should have done.
Yeah, absolutely.
My daughter loves him, by the way. She's three. She thinks Brighton Hove Albion is Bruno because of the Bruno masks.
Fair enough.
So Wally's to say my daughter, yeah, she loves Bruno.
So midfield is Stevens and Bridcut.
Yes.
With Vicente and Knockart out wide. So now we're talking about the strikers. So it's so obvious as to who one of the strikers will be. So
let's go right back to the beginning. The strikers that are involved in the first game of the decade, which is the 2nd of January 2010, as you probably already know, which was the FA Cup game away at Torquay. In that team was Liam Dickinson, Nicky Forster, Craig Davis, Glenn Murray. So Glenn Murray started he was in the team for the first game of the decade.
I don't think anyone's got a problem with Glenn Murray apart from that huge great big hole in the middle where he, you know, the wilderness years where he spent sort of just strolling around not doing much.
I'm sure the conversation's been had on here, and any Brighton Hove Albion fan, that if he hadn't have left when we went to the Championship, how much quicker we might have got to the Premier League.
And how much he'd be the all-time leading scorer.
Absolutely. Yeah. So we've got a few. Actually, when I was going through, there was not as many names as I thought there might be. I mean, there's obviously the bad ones, but let's just have a look at some of them. Chris Holwood, we're not even going to talk about him. but the first nominee on here would be Ashley Barnes.
I would.
He's in the reckoning for me.
Yeah, I actually think before we came on air, Al was saying. I think, you know, we need to have some pace in this thing, yeah. I said we needed pace, and it's how it all relates to the rest of the team. For my money, I think Barnes should be in the team alongside Murray, because I think
mostly for brutality rather than
pace. For brutality, but also because for large parts of his Brighton career, he was played out of position, left hand side, was affected, did do a good job and scored goals.
And he continues to do so for Burnley as well, and he forms out a Premier League career long before we got there.
Yeah, absolutely, and I understand why he had to go, because he would have gone on a free and all the rest of it, and for him it was obviously the right call to move, but I think we missed him. And the two standout goal scorers would have been Murray and a certain Argentinian who we'll talk about later.
Yeah.
But those two can't play together.
No, because they're basically the same.
Mm. Yeah. So
I mean, we replaced. It was a like for like replacement when that man from Argentina signed.
Yeah, but one man, he's not going to make the team. But I do want to just quickly discuss him because I loved him at the time, and he scored one of the most iconic goals of the decade for which was Fran Sandaza.
Oh, what, from 25 inches?
Yeah, the screamer from 20. But that goal against Oldham, where we went top of the table and stayed there that season, was just absolutely...
Well, it was one of those games where you think we should be getting 3 points, and it was about the 93rd minute. And you think this is one of those frustrating... We know we'd made a brilliant start under Gus. We were flying high. We were playing well. Why aren't we beating... With all due respect, we should be beating teams like Oldham. And, yeah, it took to the 93rd minute to do so. And we all love a 93rd minute winner, don't get me wrong. But there was something a bit extra about it. And it's not even in hindsight. It was at the time.
All right, OK. So, Chris Wood as well. We can't...
Yeah, but it's what he's become, isn't it?
Well, he was good at the time, but we should have signed him.
Yeah, I don't think he wanted to come.
I don't think
he was very happy.
He was at West Brom, wasn't he?
Yeah.
And then there's obviously Toby Agustin as well, who did nothing. Craig McHale-Smith, is he worthy of... I mean, I like Craig.
He wanted pace, didn't you?
Well, he would be the only one, I mean, apart from Mope, he would be the only one with real pace. And I mean, he always ran around like a wet spaniel with his hair flapping.
Yes, he did.
Once I thought of it, I could never get that.
King Charles or Springer?
Springer, definitely.
Yeah.
It's the floppy curly bits at the bottom.
Yeah.
Would he have worked well alongside Murray?
That was what I was just about to say. I think. I loved the Gus years, as I'm sure everyone did.
But that was a boo-boo, wasn't it?
Well, there was a point whereby we got rid of Murray and we brought in Craig McHale-Smith, which is great, and then we never really played to his strengths, like we didn't play to Barnes' strengths.
No.
And he missed a lot. I think probably Championship was his best level.
Mm-hmm.
When we signed him, we thought he'd be a Premier League player. Is he still at Peterborough?
Or was it
he's been all over the place. I think he's at Stevenage at the moment. He was at Notts County last year.
I've lost track of him, but
He was great.
But he was not a line leader. He's the one that you play off.
He's a pest.
It's interesting you liken him to Morpie. I'd actually more liken him to Connolly or Connolly to
him.
Yeah,
good shout. Yeah.
I've got a name here. Unfortunately, it's not the one I wanted to be, but that's Bergkamp. But then we also had Will Hoskins, who I really really liked.
I liked him,
but he got broken.
He got injured.
Didn't you meet him in the sauna?
I don't think that's the kind of question I want to answer on this radio show. Thank you very much.
George Barker. Billy Painter.
No.
No. Sam Vokes.
Are you going through the entire list I asked you not to?
No, because there isn't a very big list. Sam Vokes, I enjoyed. Scored a fantastic goal away at Nottingham Forest.
Did better for
Billy
Wales.
Painter was absolutely rubbish. Didn't do anything at all for us at all. Stephen Doby, again,
record scorer.
He did so well everywhere else, but it just didn't work for us.
There was one good game he had.
I think it was one.
But then Leo Ajar.
Do you know what? When he came back on loan that second time, he seemed a better player, but he obviously just couldn't get into the... Because his close control seemed a lot better.
It did. For being at the Champions.
And his link-up play as well.
Yeah, and half season where he came in and that run to the playoffs, I mean, he was untouchable. I mean, the team was untouchable apart from one game, moments if Ashley Barnes had not hit the crossbar,
that kind of thing,
you know. But look, Leo Ajoa is obviously will be held high in everyone's
absolutely
everyone's
although we do actually mention Murray in that song.
We do. I didn't realise, because we changed the Zamora song when he came back, but we didn't change the Ujoa song.
It must have changed, and there must have been some sort of Murray.
Well, I'm just going to read you some names here, because this is the nadir of strikers, which we absolutely love.
2013,
2014 and 2014 to 15. These were the strikers we signed: Leroy Lita, Jonathan Abika, David Rodriguez, Jesse Lingard. I guess you could call a striker.
Yeah, but he was a kid at the time, wasn't he?
Chris O'Grady, Shamir Fenelon, Adrian Kalunga. Now Sam Baldock. Now there's one who would make my team possibly. I love Sam Baldock.
He'd be on the bench, but he wouldn't make the team.
Yeah, I'd agree. I always wanted him to do better than he did. Look, and he wasn't bad. He was good. That link-up, that season where he was
Lalage with part of the Hemed. Team that got us up. I've said this many times about that 2017 side. It was sprinkled with some really, really good players, nearly all of whom put in a shift. It required the extra magic of Knockout, you know, that sort of missing ingredient. But Baldock was very much an entrenched and scored some great goals.
Bruno at one point said he was one of the most intelligent players he played with, and Bruno played with some good players. Yeah. So I think it's
so intelligent he went crowd surfing on a train.
Yeah.
Okay, I mean, we're not going to mention Leon Best or Darren Bent.
You just have.
I heard that. Yeah. But, okay, so does Bobby get a mention?
Yeah,
because he mentioned. Look, he scored quite a few goals considering he could barely walk.
Absolutely, you can hear his knees cracking.
And what was that amazing goal where the breakaway goal where he ran from the.
Oh yes,
you
could hear his knees crunching. Yeah. Was it Huddersfield?
Yeah.
But I mean, who's going to partner?
Ooh.
Glenn. It's got to be Glenn.
Okay.
I would go for Barnes.
I would go for CMS myself.
There'd be an honourable mention for Hemed, who obviously. Did well. I think the only problem I have with him was that his shots always looked a bit weak.
Yes.
But did very well for us, and
I would say best CMS, penalty per taker. Not because he was brilliant and tore up the trees, but because I can't help feeling that if he'd have played in the way that he could or should have done, i.e. alongside Murray, that would have been an unstoppable partnership. So it's a theoretical rather than an actual one here, which is a bit.
I'd go for Barnes just because he actually
knew it worked.
Well, because it worked, and he actually banged in a lot in League One.
Yeah.
I'm going to go with
Elvis Manu.
No, you're not. Who are you going with?
James Wilson.
Come on, who are you going with?
I think Ashley Barnes, personally.
I can see the argument.
The fact that he's continued to carry on with Burnley at this level, and the partnership of Barnes and Murray at the time was so good.
Admittedly, it was in the third division.
Yeah, but I mean, you could see that working for us at this level as well.
You could see it, but
yeah, I could see it working. And I think, look, just earlier on when we came in, I said, well, Brickcutt deserves to be in there because of what he did at the time, the two player of the seasons. But clearly, David Prupp is, you know, one of the best midfielders we've ever had.
So we're going with Barnes and Murray. Yes.
Yeah, I suppose we're going to have to. But I certainly want CMS in there on the bench somewhere.
Well, that's a discussion for another day because that is all we've got time for this week. So thank you to Lou Miles. When's sort of tour on again?
27th BT Sport 1, 28th BT Sport 2. On the website for free, and then some point next year.
And we'll put the link up for that as soon as it's available.
Yeah. So that's it from us.
Have we got a Christmas song to play out with?
We have. So thank you to everyone that's listened to us this year. Merry Christmas to everyone.
And next week we'll be having a review of 2019. Most of the band will be in. You'll be maybe on the phone from
Chester,
Frozen North. Yeah. But yeah, we'll be having a review of 2019. So make sure you listen out for that.
Well, yeah, so Merry Christmas, everybody, and we will see you all soon. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Hey, jingity jing. It's Dominic the donkey. Jingity jing. The Italian Christmas donkey. La la la. La 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 la. La la la. La 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 dio da. Santa's got a little friend, his name is Dominic. The cutest little donkey, you never see him kick. When Santa visits his paisans with Dominic, he'll be...